Last night we were talking about meditation as an art. The Buddha's meditation path, as you know, has these eight markers, these eight jhanas, eight stages of meditative knowledge. And tonight I'd like to go through those in detail. However, it's so easy to get caught up in the detail and lose the larger frame that I just want to quickly go through, review what I was saying last night, maybe pick up a few other points, and then we will dig into the nitty gritty of it all. Now, studying meditation is not the same as taking a class in French or auto mechanics, in many senses. But in a larger sense, that the content of the curriculum is not some body of knowledge or some ancient text or some manual someplace. That meditation, the whole curriculum here is really your life, and how you relate to that. And as such, there are these four things I was talking about last night that I think are really very important in how we relate to ourselves, I think in general, but also particularly in this. The first is it's real important to relate to ourselves with this attitude of respect and candor and kindness. Wish I had a word that encompassed all three of those, but it feels like it's a unit. So that if the quality of your mind or the quality of your thoughts, if the tone of it is derisive or flattering, if it inflates or deflates your ego, if it clashes with your highest values, then you know there's something that's out of balance there. There's something that's not as helpful as it could be, in which case you recognize, what the attitude is, release it, relax, smile, return to sending out metta, and repeat as often as necessary until that tone becomes respectful, objective, and sensitive. In other words, we seek clarity and acceptance. Nothing more, nothing less. Respect, candor, and kindness just makes the practice easier. Makes it a lot easier. And then the second thing I talked about was the importance of wholeness and balance. In any art, there are lots of details. There's technical things that have to be learned, like I was talking about the chisels with carving, learning how to work with the wood so they wouldn't dry out unevenly, all these technical things. In meditation, in this practice, there are lots of technical things. Just learning the six R's. At first, it's a lot just to remember all six of them, and then to realize that they're all actions that flow into one another and they become more like an energetic flow. And then as the practice goes very deeper, they actually change again a little bit. So they're more like attitudes or qualities or spaces that relate to, that resonate with enlightened awareness, with unconditioned awareness. Another skill that all of you have learned is working with a spiritual friend, and how to balance that between the phrases and the feeling itself. Another is how to send out metta, or kindness, or peacefulness, without too much effort, without too little. In the beginning, it takes a little bit more, but as the practice goes deeper, it too becomes automatic, and if you are putting too much effort into it, it doesn't work so well. Another skill that we haven't really talked about is, and it needs some trial and error to learn it, is when it's important to investigate, you know, to look a little more closely at what's going on, and when you're better off just standing back and letting things unfold as they will. So there are all these technical things, but if we get too much involved in them, we can lose the forest for the trees, and the thing goes out of balance. It is a middle path. So we're always balancing effort and ease. Sincere intent is really important. You have to balance that with a sense of humor. If you don't have both of those working at once, it really goes out of whack. There's this one that I hear some of you get caught in. It's how to balance paying attention to the jhana and the instructions, because they can actually move you along faster, but not getting so involved in it because it starts triggering a competition or a goal orientation. You know, that's not so helpful. How to balance going for it with letting it be. How to balance falling off on the right side of the road as often as you fall off on the left. Another way to say all that is the third thing I was talking about was paying attention to negative space. Now, meditation is really about the space, the field of awareness, not the content. It's about the attitudes in the mind and heart. Not the objects of meditation. But the most important part is this whole business of freedom, of releasing something that is already here, not really creating something. There is a sweet, still, kind, quivering awareness that is with us all the time, that is with you right at this very moment. Can you feel it? Yeah. Sometimes and oftentimes not. And it gets buried under layers of tension and stress and all kinds of things. But the practice is not cultivating, it's not creating that sweet, kind, open, clear awareness. It's really getting the stuff out of the way so it can come forward. And in the process of doing that, particularly in early jhanas, there is oftentimes a lot of detailed instructions and sometimes some push with it, like the way Alan came up with my hammer and smashed that little arch I was working on there as a way of saying to me, Doug, look, just don't be so compulsive. You got to relax. Take it easy. Sometimes the lessons can be very forceful. But as the practice goes deeper, it really gets, the instructions get lighter and lighter and depend much more on an intuitive awareness and trusting the guidance within us. Of course, if we just said, if it feels good, do it, those are the only instructions, too many people would just, you know, get a beer and sit back and watch TV, or fall into other old habits, like I have this tendency to be obsessive. You know, you can just like fall right into that. But as the practice goes deeper, I find myself saying to a lot of people that basically what you want to do is do nothing and six are everything. And if we do that, it gradually reveals this quiet, luminous awareness, which is what we're setting free. So That's the review from last night. Any thoughts or comments or parts of that before we dig into it? Okay. So to move into the jhanas themselves, I want to read you some of the text to try to get a little closer to the source material. And as I read these, bear in mind, as I said before, that many of these were not written down until centuries after the Buddha. And so it's a little bit, reading the jhanas, it's like looking, it would be as if you or I were trying to reconstruct a conversation at a specific occasion with Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, when the only material he had to go on was something that had been passed down by word of mouth. And also, bear in mind that the monks who were trying to preserve this material were not as interested in the specific wording as that they were in distilling the essence of what he was saying in as few words as possible so it would be easier to memorize. And then you have this added problem of the most of the translations we have are done by scholars, right, who are really tend to focus on technical accuracy. They're not necessarily poets, so the language can become very stilted and stylized. So that as we read these things, we really don't have what we would like, would be a front row seat, you know, at the Buddha's feet. It's really more like we're in the back row or up in the balcony, but it gets us a little closer to it. So the words I want to share with you come from the Anapada Sutta. It's Majjhima Nikaya 111, and it's one of the more succinct descriptions of the jhanas. And I'll just read you the description of the first jhana, and then I'll take it apart a little bit, and then we'll explore the others from there. I'll just read the text through straight, and then I'll go back and read it a second time and unpack it. Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, Sariputta. Sariputta was one of the Buddha's top disciples, and he had an incredible intellectual gift, his capacity to articulate finely what was going on was just extraordinary. So in this sutta, the Buddha is not referring to his own experience, but is referring to Sariputta's. Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasure, secluded from unwholesome states, Sariputta entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought, with joy and happiness born of seclusion. And the states in the first jhana, the thinking, the examining thought, the joy, the happiness, and the unification of mind, the contact, feeling, perception, formations in mind, the enthusiasm, choice, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention, these states were defined by him one by one as they occurred. Known to him, those states arose. Known, they were present. Known, they disappeared. He understood thus. So indeed, these states, not having been, come into being. Having been, they vanish. Regarding those states, he abided, unattached, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, dissociated, with a mind rid of barriers. Okay. Can you repeat all that back? This particular translation comes from Bhikkhu Bodhi, and his translations were also done with the help of the notes of his teacher, Nanamoli Bhikkhu. And this has been reworked a little bit by Bondi Vimal Ramsey and myself. Let me go back through it again. Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures. So how do you seclude yourself from sensual pleasures?
Come to a retreat.
Come to a retreat.
Close your eyes.
Close your eyes.
Sit still.
Pardon?
Sit still.
Sit still. 6R. I mean, all of those. But we, because you know, the 6 R's are a way of releasing what's been, you know, when something pulls you into it. Quite secluded from sensual pleasure, secluded from unwholesome states. What are unwholesome states?
Hindrances.
Yeah, yeah. Sariputta entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought. There are many words in Pali for that translate as thought. Vitakka refers to when a thought comes up, it's actually the first thing that points to what you're thinking about. And vikara is a wholesome kind of thinking, so that if you're sitting down and trying to figure out what something is, it's when you're looking at it cleanly, objectively, and openly. Papancha, which he's not talking about. I just love the word papancha, just the sound of it. Papancha is kind of rambling thought proliferation. So he's talking about thinking vitakka and examining thought are part of the first jhana. So there's thinking in the first jhana. The joy, happiness, and unification of mind. Do you recognize what that's talking about? You know how there are those, in the first jhana, there are these little spikes of joy. Sometimes there's spikes, and sometimes they can be quite large, and sometimes they're small. But this joy comes up spontaneously, and then it'll fade pretty quickly. You know, down into a quieter joy, which is called sukha, happiness, and then it can fade down into this broader, more peaceful equanimity, which has so little energy into it that the mind wanders. So it goes bloop. And that those little blips can actually be very quick. And that's actually one of the markers of the first jhana.
Unification of mind is referring to peaceful.
Yeah, it's the peace, it's the peacefulness. The translations are hard. Collectedness, it's like equanimity. What happens is the mind it kind of settles. And there's just a quiet sort of presence of mind that doesn't have any tension. It's not something that's being held there at all, but the mind just feels like just there. Okay. Joy. Yeah.
So when is the thinking and examination happen?
It's just when it appears up, and that's what you do. You 6R it. All he's saying is that the first jhana has these things in it. It's not talking about. It's not saying that you sit down and think in this way. It just says that this is what happens during. So it's not. This is not an instruction. Okay. So the instructions are, as you say, is just to recognize, you know, the joy if it comes up, or if there are hindrances, or there's thinking, then you just 6R it.
Do you realize what is thinking, what is examination during the meditation?
No. You don't have to do that analysis. Okay. Just saying those here. So we have this long list of stuff that comes up. It's again, it's not instructions. So in some Buddhist circles, the jhanas are described as more as a one-pointed absorption where there's nothing else going on. To get in the first jhana, all the stuff has to be gone. And so this, it's really important to see how it's described in the text, that you can be in the first jhana and still have thoughts, you know, coming in.
So could I interject a thought that I have about...
Is it a vitaka or a vikara?
Unification. Papaja. So, I describe the unification of mind as the mind is now, instead of wandering around, sort of aimlessly bouncing around, it's preoccupied on the object of observation for a little longer than it has been, and that's that resting place. So the preoccupation of mind in a state that is has continuity on the object of meditation for a while.
Yeah.
It's settling down.
Yeah. Listen to him. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Good. Good. Thanks.
And the difference between that and highly concentrated practices is the preoccupation. On a single object, and we are not preoccupying on a single object.
Right.
That's the difference.
Yeah. Okay. Joy, happiness, and unification of mind. There's five qualities that come next, so see if you can recognize what these are. This is the quiz today. Contact, feeling, perception, formations, and mind. Does anybody recognize that collection of five? Pardon? Those are five aggregates. So we haven't talked about the five aggregates here, but the five aggregates are khandhas, I think of them as a kind of a dependent origination light. What they are clusters of experience, different kind of qualities of experience. So the first one are raw sensation. There's a feeling tone. Pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral is another kind of experience we can have. There is perception, which is a kind of labeling. So there's a sensation, there's a label that's put on it. The third one doesn't translate into English very well. It's sankhara. It refers to thoughts, storylines, concepts, ideas, that whole thinking realm of experience. And in this translation, it's mind, it's vijnana, it's awareness. Okay, so if you think of those five, there's actually nothing we can experience that doesn't fit into one of those five. Right? Sensation, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, perception, labeling, thinking, storylines, etc., and awareness itself, the mind itself. Everything we experience fits into one of those. So it's a way that the Buddha was describing the whole of what we experience. And so we have in the first jhana, you know, the whole of what's possible to experience is part of the description of the stuff that can happen in it. The enthusiasm, choice, energy, mindfulness, equanimity, and attention, these states were defined by him, are recognized by him, one by one as they occurred. Known to him, those states arose. Known they were present. Known they disappeared. So what's that referring to? Impermanence. Sees that they're there, they're not there, they're there, they hang around, they leave. It's one of the sort of basic qualities of all things. So that the jhanas are not just static experience, but there's you'll see the arising and passing of all kinds of things. He understood thus, so indeed these states, not having been, come into being, having been, they vanish. Regarding those states, he abides unattached, unrepelled. So he's regarding those states, he's not attached to them. So he's just observing, he's not attached to them, he's not freaked out by them. That's unrepelled. That would be my translation, but what do I know? Independent, detached, free, dissociated. See, we have a clinical psychological. Dissociated just means impersonal here. Means impersonal. So there's no self that's put on. A mind rid of barriers. A mind rid of barriers. He sees how it all works. Okay. So, in the first jhana, the markers are that you see, well, you start off sending out loving kindness, compassion, joy, peacefulness, and those are flowing out, and your six are, and then at some point in there, you notice that these little bits of joy that come up. It's like you're sitting there, you know, this is nice. And it can pass fairly quickly. And that's just the first jhana. And one of the things that I think that's kind of ingenious about defining the path this way is that joy is something that is relatively dense and that is easy to recognize and feel. You know, we all know what joy feels like. And so, and then these little things that come up, and that's where the whole thing starts. And again, as Jordan was pointed out, this is not one-pointed, it's not absorption, concentration. And I have to say that you know, I've read some of the other teachers around who teach the absorption jhanas, and when I read their descriptions, they don't sound as one-pointed absorption as they are sometimes described from people who don't do those. There's a little more fluidity in them. But for people who don't know about the jhanas, and that oftentimes they get the stereotype of this. And there are schools that do that.
The absorption jhana, is it that's a separate set of jhanas or the higher
jhanas? No, it's a separate set. It's a separate set. And there is out there in the Buddha land what some people refer to as jhana wars, which is actually battling over who gets to win, you know, who defines how they are. When I think of jhana wars, I think of Ralph Waldo Emerson. He wrote a letter to his brother once. He had riled up the whole countryside with some of his thoughts and ideas, and he wrote to his brother. He said, we understand that some people are a bit vexed because of our wicked teachings. I trust they will recover their composure. So I just want to note that stuff out there, and I have no interest in actually engaging over fighting out, you know, which is the best. I don't have a franchise on the language. And words actually mean what they mean to people. So it's not for me to define, but I do like to make those distinctions. So you know what I'm talking about. This is what I mean. Some people have other ideas and other practices. Okay, any other questions about the first jhana? Yes?
You talked about when you have joy, means you enter the first jhana already?
Yeah. The jhana is described this way of, you know, there's a little bit of that unification of mind. So it's not a joy that's running all over the countryside, but it's Yeah, I haven't heard the question framed quite that way. It's an interesting one. You know, can they get in the first jhana without being intentionally practicing to get there? And if you do, is that a legitimate jhana? And I think if it has those qualities, if it's a joy, a little bit of joy, that then moves into a kind of a peacefulness, that is what the jhana is talking about.
Does that mean you are in the first jhana already?
When you prepare your mind? It depends on how it feels. You know, if there's a bit of joy and happiness and ease, yeah. I think people slip into these and out of them a lot. And, and what this path is about is, and it starts in this very simple, very accessible place. So you kind of have a toe in the door, and then it refines it from there.
So I view it as joy and happiness in association with the stillness of the unification of mind. Unification of mind has a sense of stillness and rest to it. And so these arise together. But there is still thinking. In other words, the mind is still asking questions and has the power to think. It's still thinking, but it's not running off, getting lost, and hooked into the hindrances as quickly. It's settling down. So it's in association. There's five jhana factors in the first jhana. That's what he just talked about.
Is there without laughter?
But it's without...
Not necessarily.
I think you can, yeah. It's kind of giggles, though.
Yeah. For some people, it's not a requirement. I think the real marker of it is, and it's not necessarily rise all the same, but there is this little spike of joy. And there are these five factors that Jordan is referring to. I don't find those in the very earliest texts. So, you all know what the first jhana is, so.
But like, I also experience joy just in bringing forth the wholesome state.
Yes.
So yeah. It might arise right at the start.
It could, yes. Yeah. Particularly the first jhana is not a castle with turrets and high walls that you have to climb over. It's fairly accessible. Fairly accessible.
From what I understand, your question is that it's not associated with a thought. It's more just open, equanimous. It's not, my son graduated today, I'm so happy. It's not dependent on a thought that creates the happiness or the joy. It is there. It arises in from emptiness.
Yeah, I think it can be the way. They all have causes and conditions. Some of them are real subtle, but yeah, I agree with you. It's not something that I'm so happy I get to see this movie.
Right, and that's what I heard your question.
Okay.
Is it like, can you just have a good thought and then you're in a jhana?
Yeah,
not
no.
And a thought and a jhana is more if you're in a meditative space. So there's not really thought that creates the joy. The joy arises from the stillness.
And the joy is not necessarily attached, hook, line, and sinker, you know, to the thought. There can be the thought, there can be thinking, etc., that's there, but that's not what the essence of it is. We'll have to work on our translation skills here.
So I've been trying to say about that often my experience is that if I cultivate the joy, the smile going, I'm working, and then finally, yeah, it pops in, then my mind will find something to be joyful about. That
right.
Will fill in some storyline about that, and I'll remember a time in which I was with a group of people and I told a joke that they got and it was fun, and that will kind of return, even if it's really stupid.
Right.
Just like, okay, we're doing the joy thing, here's an image for that.
Right. I think that happens a lot, that the state comes first and the mind looks for an excuse for it. And if the mind really gets caught in the joke and retelling it, it slip out of the jhana. Okay.
That's jhana.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, your initial instruction, that's the way I heard it, for bringing joy and or happiness to mind was to basically remember something that made you feel a sense of joy. In other words, somehow to bring it to mind, even start, even have a place to start.
Right. Yeah, and that's tricky, and it's to get the balance on that instruction is really hard sometimes, because when somebody's starting out, you can say remember a time, and then it's always with I try to make this qualification over and over again. To remember a time because you felt it. It's natural. It's not about the time, and it's not about thinking about that, but it's what that felt like, and you can remember what that felt like, and let that be there, and then send it out. And sometimes, I think what the jhana really is you can be sending it out, and there's that good feeling, and then there is a place sometime where you're sitting there. It's sort of like what Sarah was saying, that kind of unbidden. There's this little feel this little feeling of sweetness. That is not linked that tightly to whatever it is you're thinking about, but it's just right there in the moment. It just kind of comes up. And so in starting with a memory or just remembering what that feels like and invoking that, it's trying to set up a resonance, you know, that'll kind of hook into that state. But it's not the memory. It's not what happened back then. It's actually, you know, in the present. Something that has a kind of fullness and a completeness of it its own, even if it's short-lived.
To extend one of your analogies, the kind of way I see it, very first instruction you get just to have somebody even have a place to start the first night, whatever, is kind of like digging the well. You're digging the well to find that memory of a joy or happiness, and then you wait. So you use the analogy of priming the pump. For
right.
The phrase is priming the pump. And now the more spontaneous occurrences of the joy without necessarily is kind of like just a spring.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. The only place I would just be careful about a little bit is, at least for me, the image of digging a well. Seems like a lot of work. Okay. That's great, because the idea behind it is that it's something that's very close and very natural and something we've experienced a lot, and so if digging the well doesn't get you caught up in, you know, in the exertion of it, it's great. That's great. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
It's almost incidental. It's just, it arrives, it might go
calm down, it'll come back, it'll come back. But it's in no way you trying to get something, or it just seems like.
That's, yes, you're doing something which can trigger it, but the actual experience of it, it can be one that comes out of nowhere. And there is, you know, the text in here where he's talking about, you know, he sees it come, watch it there, and it goes. And it seems to be kind of impersonal in that sense. Okay. Any more First Jhana stories? We'll be here till 11 o'clock. So, I think I'll just describe these. The text of it all follows this kind of formulaic pattern with different things put in for the various jhanas. What happens is there is a little spike, and it's gone fairly quickly. And then as you continue to practice, it becomes a little less of a spike and more of a wave. In other words, it lasts a little bit longer, a little bit longer. The joy may stay a little bit longer, and it recedes not quite so quickly, and the peacefulness stays longer. And as you experience that, the yogis experience that, there's a sense of, oh, you know, this is actually working. You know, you've seen some change and a little bit of deepening, and it builds a little bit of confidence in the practice. So it's that longer joy. The thinking goes a little bit further in the background. It's not gone completely, but it quiets down a little bit. And there's this confidence. Ah, you know, because when you go into the first jhana, there's oftentimes, well, I don't know about this, but there's a little bit of experience that now builds that confidence. And as this happens, you find yourself sitting a little bit longer, typically. And you'll find that the amount of time that the mind stays collected and still can be a little bit longer. You're still six-R-ing, but all that begins to shift a little bit. Then what happens is peacefulness gets so strong that the joy doesn't quite arise. You're just sitting there, and it goes right into happiness, right into an equanimity. It becomes very, very peaceful. And we're moving into the third now. So quickly. Yeah, the line between the first and second and the second and third, there is no line. It's really a gradation. And I always think of this path as I described it earlier, that Buddha put markers on it. So as it's longer, you can say, okay, this is longer than it was here, but the transition from one to the other is not like stepping over somebody's wall. It just lengthens out. One of the things that happens in giving interviews, which can be amusing, is that when people come in, when they have moved into the third jhana, is that there's this feeling that they've lost the practice, you know, because that joy and delight that was there, it's not there. And so typically, you know, when you're in my position, you say, okay, so are there any problems? No. It's very peaceful. But the joy is gone. So are you having any difficulties with this? No. This nail caught my arm, and I have this gash, but I put a tape over it, and it'll be fine, but no problems, but the joy is gone. The other thing that I left out is in the second jhana, what happens is as this arc gets longer, it gets so strong that most people find that using the phrases feels like it's just not helpful anymore. So there'll be the feeling, and then to bring up the phrases, it kind of brings them down out of it a little bit. So the phrases begin to feel clunky and awkward in the beginning. They're very helpful. And usually what happens at that point is the instructions are just to drop the phrases. You don't need them anymore. It was a priming the pump. Once it's flowing, you don't need anymore. Some people like to keep using them for a little while longer, and that's fine. And also typically in the second jhana is it's not so important to send metta to yourself first. You can just send it out to your spiritual friend. And for some people, depending on temperament and history and stuff, it actually feels good to send it to themselves for a while longer, and that's fine. But usually the metta, the compassion, the joy, peacefulness is strong enough that even to bring it up and send it, you actually feel it for yourself, so it becomes simpler. When the Buddha used the term noble silence, he was actually referring to this dropping away of needing to use the phrases of this quieting of thought. And noble silence has been used in many other ways, oftentimes in retreats, as a way of describing not speaking to one another. But in the text, it's usually described this this quieting. Okay. Anything more about the first three jhanas?
I didn't hear the text. It's usually noble silence.
Yeah, noble silence refers to this place where some of the thinking has subsided into the background, and there's actually no longer a need to use that. You sit there and you can bring up and send out the metta, the joy, etc.
Maybe you sign a second.
Yes. Yeah. By the way, I won't pass them out now. You look at them, but you're all welcome to one of these. It's kindness and wisdom practice. The last half of Buddha's map has a fairly detailed description of all the jhanas, and this is the Cliff Note version. The reason I wrote it was that as people get up and move through the jhanas, sometimes they have a hard time remembering, you know, did this come up here, or what's that, or what do you do with this practice, or something. This has all the practices, but without any elucidating stories and examples and stuff. It's just the bare bones. So you're welcome to one of those if you'd like one.
I think in Buddha's map you use the word comfort in to describe a quality like the third jhana.
Yeah.
Physical comfort.
Yeah, there's a comfortable abiding is a phrase that's used there, and it's palpable. You can see it when people come in. You know, and they may think they've lost everything, but there's just a kind of a quietness about them.
In the absorption jhanas, which I've done, the first three jhanas are considered the real fun ones.
Mm-hmm.
But by around the second jhana, the internal dialogue really shuts off. And you're more glued into your object of contemplation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very different than what we do, but it definitely is. I studied with a yoga master in India, and he teaches four different levels in each jhana to develop using absorption.
Yeah.
So it can get very sophisticated. But the mind is not very agile like this. This is agile mind. Some people call these light jhanas. They're not light. They're profound.
They are light and profound.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're actually both. And in the third jhana too, you can feel some of that, you know, that there will be the thinking going on, but you can still feel this place of this, you know, comfortable, peaceful abiding that is there, even as there's other stuff going on. It doesn't pull you away from it so strongly. And the third jhana is sometimes called rupa upekkha. Upekkha means equanimity, and rupa means body. So it translates as equanimity with body, or body sensations. So what happens now is you continue practicing, and the whole system is getting so relaxed and so quiet that it stops sending out, the body stops sending out as many signals. I think we touched on this some other evenings. What I think of in this is when I was 5 or 6 years old, I used to like to, when I was in the bathtub, when I was still small enough that I could stretch out the whole length, and I would lay back, and my ears would go under the water, but if I relaxed, my nose would be out, and so I could breathe, and I was relaxed, floating there, usually in all these bubbles, and I tried to see if I could relax enough so that my arms and legs would disappear. Any of you ever do that? And so you're lying there in this deeply relaxed, oh, my arms are going, you know, and then you just move them a little bit and they're all back there completely. So what happens in the fourth jhana is that even while you're sitting up in a chair rather than floating in a bathtub, is that it gets so relaxed that there are parts of the body that may fade from your awareness. And it's not like they warp into some other zone, because if you look at them, if you focus a lot of attention on them, the awareness will come right back. Or if a bug walks across them, you'll feel it. It's very different than what we usually call a part of the body going to sleep, which is the blood flow or the nerve. Gets impinged upon. I remember my father, his foot went to sleep in the night, and he got up out of bed, and when he stood on his foot, it didn't work, and it collapsed, and he broke it. So this doesn't happen here. All the physiology is there. It's working fine. It's just so mellowed out that it's not producing. And there is this in-between place where everything is deeply relaxed, but there are just very faint signals coming out. So I don't know if some of you had the experience of sitting there meditating, and it actually feels like, you know, you're sitting like this, and you open your eyes, and it's surprising that your body is upright. Any of you have that? Yeah. So I think what happens there is the body still is sending out signals, but they are so faint that the brain doesn't quite know how to interpret them. So you get all these different kind of kinesthetic sensations. So,
question. What is
rupa? Rupa means body.
I've heard on one of Bhante's YouTube videos, he talks about the first four jhanas being rupa and the next four being arupa.
Right.
What are those words? What's the difference between those words?
So what we're talking about right now is that the body sensations fade. And it's not just kinesthetic sensations. Did I talk about, I know I talked to somebody, did I talk about here about meditating up in the High Sierras and the trucks? So I was doing a retreat up at this woman's house. John Travis was teaching it. And I think it's about 6,000 feet, so it's way up there. And there was the pass was about a half a mile from there, and so the trucks would come over this pass, and then the road went about maybe 150 feet from our house. So as they would come down, you know, as trucks do, they downgrade. It sounds like a truck on flatulences. And in the beginning, when I was first there on the retreat, it was just incredibly annoying. And then later on the retreat, I was just so glad the trucks had stopped. And so I went and checked, and no, the trucks were still there. It's just that it seems like the sound had just faded, you know, a long way away. And what happens with this is there's a lot of stability. So, for example, if the mind is deeply absorbed and somebody drops a garbage can outside and there's this huge crash, if it's strong enough to break through into the awareness, there's a startle because you're brought back really quite abruptly. What happens in the soft jhanas, awareness jhanas, is that you're very quiet and there's this big sound and it almost just feels like an energy wave that goes through your body. It just sort of passes through, but you're undisturbed by it. So this can be confusing for people because in this practice we're really trying to cultivate this wide open field of awareness that is open, you know, to seeing what things. But there can be, at the same time, there can be this growing stability that you're just not thrown off anymore. Okay. So, fifth jhana. What happens is that the relaxation, the body sensations are fading away, the sounds, smells, and stuff disappear or at a long distance or not disturbing, and you get this feeling of incredible spaciousness. I remember sitting up in my attic in our house when we live on the East Coast, meditating in the middle of the night, and it was very dark, and I was sitting there, and it was very dark, very peaceful, and it was sort of like sitting in a closet. Everything was black, and then all of a sudden, it was like I was suspended out between the galaxies. Just this vast feeling of spaciousness. That's the kind of the greatest extreme of it. Even had a little bit of vertigo. More typically, it's just. It's just a feeling of spaciousness.
Without a center.
Yeah, that's a traditional description. That it's a sense of expansion without a center. I used to go into the fifth jhana when I was about 5 or 6. We would be out playing cowboys and Indians, and I got shot. And so what you're supposed to do when you're playing cowboys and Indians is just lie there in the grass, you know, dead. And so I'd lie there in the grass, completely relaxed, you know, looking up at the sky. And there was this sensation of, if you ever had that, of looking at the sky and it seems like the clouds are moving away, but they're not. Is that familiar to anybody? Yeah. That sensation of that expansion without actually moving is very typical of the fifth jhana. People will experience that in there. And so I would say to my older brother, Ricky, this is really neat. Have you ever seen this? Dog, you're an idiot, get up. The instructions shift. Somewhere at the end of the third, typically more in the fourth jhana, but before going into the fifth, where you go through this series of practices that I call removing the barriers is the first one. Mm-hmm. Removing the barriers. So what you're doing there is you pick another spiritual friend and you send metta, kindness, peacefulness, to them until you can see them smile. And then you move on to another one. And another one. You do about 4 of those. And then when you could see all of them smiling one at a time, then you move to all family members, or if you have some really close friends that feel like family, and you send kindness, peacefulness, to each of them until you can see them smiling. And if one of those family members is just really, really difficult for you, it's okay to pass them up and we'll pick them up later. Okay. These particular practices come out of some traditional cultures where there's... And then you go to neutral people. These are people who... maybe somebody, you know, you see on the bus every day, or somebody you pass in the hall, you know, at work, but you may say a few words here and there, but you don't really know them. Grocery store clerk, people you see around. But you don't have much charge from one way or another. And so you send metta, kindness, to them till you can see them smile. And then you come to the last category, which is traditionally called the enemy. And these are the people who get under your skin. And if they're family members, this is where they come back in. And you send kindness to them until you can see them smile. The trick with the enemies is to be sure you don't get involved in the storylines with the difficult people. You know, I really don't like this, that, and that, and it's not relevant. You just six-R that, and you send it to them. And if you get really caught in them, what you do is that you leave them, you come back to a neutral person and send out metta to them until it gets flowing, and then you bring it back to them. And you only have to do this until you can see them smiling once. This is one of those instructions that really mystifies me, because particularly when I'm teaching classes, people will do this over and over and over again. And I know they do it over and over again, so when I give them instructions, I say, you only have to do it once. You don't have to do it over and over again. But people do, and I'm not quite sure what it is. In one case, there was a guy who really got what the instructions were, but he was getting so much insight and loved it so much that he did it for 8 weeks. And as long as it was clear that I wasn't saying he had to do that, and he wondered, that was fine with me. But it's, you just till you see them smiling once. And what we're doing here is just making sure that the metta and all this stuff goes out to all kinds of people. Ones that you like, ones that you don't like, ones that you feel neutral. One of the traditional descriptions of metta, they say it's like a soft rain, you know, that falls in the garden and the junk heap and just falls in everything equally. So it's making sure that the metta flows equally. I had a yogi once who said to me, I just love this practice. He just loves sending out metta to all people who deserve it. Who deserve it? And I said, no, that's not quite it. You know, when I originally did training in metta from Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein and stuff, they would do all those categories, and you would actually spend a couple days on each category. And that's how it's taught. But I actually like this way of doing it, because you get to the point that the metta is flowing really, really strongly, the easiest way possible, you know, with a spiritual friend or with yourself. And then when it's really strong, you just make sure that it goes equally, rather than, as I said, I can be a little compulsive, and when it gets broken down to, you know, how many days you spend on this, it gets a little too regimented for me. What else?
And that really is that the actual practice itself is starting to transform the person, because when you do that, you're different afterwards than you would be before, in terms of being able to send metta to people who previously you couldn't feel okay enough about to be able to send metta.
Yes, and so it's a little bit of a quiz, you know, to see if you can do that, and some people will get caught, and it's, you know, it's a check. But mostly, you know, if I'm paying attention to what's going on, I don't give this practice until I'm pretty confident. And sometimes people, particularly the enemies, might get caught a little bit. But if they're, you know, if they're really ready, they'll work that through quickly, and then you get the experience of having it flow equally to all.
So the instruction is only employed when the instructor, the teacher, gives it to the
teacher. That's right.
And to be clear,
just what?
Not once each sitting, but once and for all.
Once and for all. typically, you know, on a retreat, most people can do the full thing in one sitting or maybe two. You know, if you've read the chapter in my book, I did it for a long time, and basically because I got through the other end at about 9:30 at night, and Bhante had already gone down to his kuti, and I didn't want to interrupt him, you know, go and wake up. He said, come and get him at any time, but I didn't, so I just went through the whole thing, and then I started to send it to Dick Cheney and... that's actually not a part of this practice. These are all people who you know personally. And part of the reason for that is, you know, political figures are really caricatures to most of us. I have never sat down in a room and looked into Dick Cheney's eyes. I don't know who he really is. I just know I hear from him in the press. And I just know I want to keep sharp objects out of his hands, but I don't know that much about him. So it's always with people you know. The reason that we start off with individual people, because what's going to happen now is it's going to, you know, in the fifth jhana as I described, maybe it didn't, is it starts going out to all people. And a lot of people just want to hop up to that one. It feels so good just to send out metta to everybody in the whole world. And I always think of Charlie Brown when he said, I love humanity, it's people I can't stand. So this practice starts with individual people to make sure you really have it grounded and rooted in individual real people, including ones who are difficult. And then once it flows equally to those, then we can turn to this broader practice, which is the second part of this, which is that after that, when you've gotten through all of those and it works, then you start off sending metta to all beings in front of you, all beings behind you, left, right, above, and below. And at first, it's... Bhante always says 5 minutes, I think 2 or 3 minutes in each direction, just to make sure it's flowing in that direction. So you do those one at a time in the six directions, and then once it's going in all six directions, then you start sending it out to all beings everywhere, all the time. It feels like you're inside this this ball or this bubble, and you're just sending out, you know, these waves of metta. And at this point, typically, people are sitting comfortably, you know, at least an hour or longer. There's a subtleness and a quietness. And at this point, we have shifted from the rupa jhanas, which are the first three, up into the arupa jhanas, as the body sensations have faded away. In the text, they usually talk about four jhanas and four bases. I first learned this from Bhante, just as eight jhanas. That's how he used to teach it. And I just find that easier than kind of breaking the stuff up. So I usually describe it that way. But in the text, there are the three arupa jhanas with the body. And then there is a arupa jhana, which has four bases to it. The way I learned it, the way I like to teach it, is a fourth jhana is the first one, and then we'll move up into the basis with 5, 6, 7, and 8. So in 5 is what I began to describe before, was we get this spaciousness.
Can I ask a question? I mean, maybe this isn't the right place to answer it, but I'd like to find out how you teach it. So that when people establish a great deal of equanimity, it's very hard to send out metta. Metta lasts for about 5 seconds and sort of dissolves into equanimity. So I'd like to, sometime when we have a few minutes is to figure out when the best time to teach this is, because once there's super solid equanimity, that the use of metta seems not to work so well.
Yeah, well, you typically go back to metta because you're shifting from one person to a whole large bunch of people. When I teach it, I don't get into the distinctions. There is in the text, and Bhante is talking about it more and more, about the specific qualities that are being sent out. So, for example, in the fifth jhana, you're actually sending out metta, love and kindness, that has a particular quality to that. In the sixth, you're sending out compassion. The problem I have with that is most people don't know what compassion feels like. Because when you feel a lot of compassion, you're really focused on the other person, but what that actually feels inside. So what actually occurs inside is that the quality of the metta changes a little bit. It feels a little softer. It feels a little kind of, I won't say fuzzy, but it just has a softer quality. And that's what the Buddha was talking about in that. And again, in the text, it said, in the early hours of the morning, he would get up and he would go into the fifth jhana and radiate compassion to the whole world, to all beings.
I'm going to radiate a little compassion to this guy. Sometimes.
He doesn't want to go.
Yes, he does.
I have a question for you about that.
Yes.
So, I'm just curious why the Buddha would do that. Of course, being loving and kind to everybody is generally just, that's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But somebody who's been all the way through this and they've achieved enlightenment, why would they go back? And then it almost seems, maybe it's just a technical question, but why would you've achieved full enlightenment, why would you go and sit in this space? Why would you do that? That seems like you did that on the way there.
Because he didn't have TV. I think of that the line from Mary Oliver poem, the closing of it, where she says, "So what are you going to do with one wild and wonderful life? Fully enlightened, there's actually no more work to be done. You're just there. So what are you going to do?
Hang out and love people, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah." It's just it's a nice way to abide. There's that phrase in the text a lot too. They talk about the day is abiding. You know, so what are you going to do? You know, why not?
The other night, I think you kind of made some distinctions that compassion was what you offer toward beings who are maybe a little less further on the path, and metta towards maybe like a peer.
Yeah, it's you can think of it that way, but it's the way it's usually described in the text is someone whose state of happiness and well-being is less than yours. It would be compassion if they were greater, and where they are on the path could be a measure of that. But it actually there are lots of people who radiate a lot of compassion and know nothing about jhanas or the path, but it's just.
I guess one of my questions, sorry about the misidentification there, but I mean, the point is, are you radiating compassion only, or are you radiating metta and joy, I mean, all three, so to speak?
So, from my perspective, you radiate uplifted states, and you don't try to control it. Whatever comes up that's uplifted, you radiate it. And what will happen is metta of, has a various texture to it that people may not be very familiar with. Compassion has this softer. And so I may ask people, what their experience of us, and that'll be clues to me about where they are in the jhanas, but there are other clues as well.
Sending that compassion, fifth,
Oh, for compassion? I was wrong. Okay, okay. It's bound to happen at least once during the retreat, right now.
Another question that's been nagging me well before I even came here. If I can still get this one person to smile, can I still hold a grudge?
I mean, I know it's a facetious question, but I'm actually trying to think of an actually straight answer. Is that yes, you could, but why would you?
Yeah, obviously it's not the preferred state. But
right, right.
It's not necessarily something I can control or be forevermore kind of thing.
Yeah. So what'll happen? You know, these states are not pure, so you can be sending out in there, and you know, feeling of a grudge will come up, and so we six are it. You know, it's like recognizing there's a contracted state. And technically, at those times, they might say that you actually came out of the jhana, you know, as the grudge came up.
I'm predicting I can resolve or address the grudge now. I mean, forgive and everything, but tomorrow.
Yes. Well, there's a deep, you know, pockets of stuff in all of us, that stuff, you know, that get exposed, and those blasts of stuff that'll come up sometimes. And so technically what happens, like if a grudge came up, is it would pull you out of the jhana. You're no longer in that state. However, in your practice, you would still do the same practice because you've actually experienced it. That's where your leading edge is. That's what your system is capable of. And so you go back to the same practice of sending out, you know, compassion. And until you come back into the jhana. And it keeps in.
What you said earlier is you don't, the goal is to get them to smile and don't get, if they're in the enemy group. I had one individual, it's very challenging, but it was not getting caught up in the story of why I had so much anger and why they were in the enemy camp. Eventually that person did smile and went.
Yeah. And you know, and with the anger and the grudges and stuff like that, particularly, you know, if you have some, you know, a lot of spaciousness, you begin to see, you know, holding a grudge doesn't affect that one person necessarily at all, but it sure messes up your experience, and so then it brings a lot of motivation to actually bring some wisdom and kindness to yourself, so that you're not holding it. If somebody wants to be a jerk, let them be a jerk. You know, you send them kindness and they can do what they want. It's okay. Let them be.
I see compassion as where I don't see a difference between myself and the importance of myself and somebody else. The sort of self-importance starts to shrink with metta. But by compassion, it's where I'm viewing all of us the same. And there's just a sort of non-differential. And the idea of not self or an impersonal self started to really develop.
Yeah, well, I'll get more into that in the coming evenings. But, you know, the indiscriminateness of it, it depends a lot on the person and the temperament. A lot of people, you know, will find that sense of selflessness and the equality and stuff comes very natural for them. Other people, you know, because of reason of their history or who knows, past lives or whatever, it doesn't come as readily, so everybody has different talents and stuff. So where this, how those things show up are not described so much in terms of the description of the jhanas themselves, but they are sort of basic insights that are really important to the whole path.
Well, I was the elder son, so I always thought the world revolved around me.
Yeah, yeah, we all know that. And we're actually grateful to how you're channeling that into putting together these retreats and everything else. It's really
well.
And the weather.
Even these guys.
Do you all know my poem about the duck? I should have read that earlier when I talked about equanimity. I think I have it here somewhere. This is a poem that was written by Donald C. Babcock, and it first appeared in the New Yorker magazine in October of 1947. And so I like to think, because I was born in the spring of 1948, I like to think it was composed about the same time I was conceived, but it probably wasn't. And it's one of my favorite poems of all time. And it's about equanimity. I have a yogi who, after he heard this, sent me this picture of a duck sitting out in the ocean, and he had put these letters over top of it that said, equanimity. Now we're ready to look at something pretty special. It is a duck, right in the ocean 100 feet beyond the surf. No, it isn't a gull. A gull always has a raucous touch about him. This is some sort of duck, and he cuddles in the swells. He isn't cold, and he is thinking things over. There is a big heaving in the Atlantic, and he's part of it. He looks a bit like a mandarin or the Lord Buddha meditating under the bo tree. But he has hardly enough above the eyes to be a philosopher. He has poise, however, which is what philosophers must have. He can rest while the Atlantic heaves because he rests in the Atlantic. Probably he doesn't know how large the ocean is, and neither do you. But he realizes it. And what does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. He reposes in the immediate as if it were infinity, which it is. That is religion. And the duck has it. He has made himself part of the boundless by easing himself into it just where it touches him. I like the little duck. He doesn't know much. But he has religion. So if you're not sure what equanimity is, just remember the duck. It's sitting in the waves. People think of equanimity as calming the waves. But I would say, good luck with that. Good luck with that. Far back in history, as we can see, there have been waves and wars and all kinds of stuff. It's actually learning to actually sit and ride in it.
Are you
going to
tell us about the sixth jhana tonight?
You still got time? Okay, let's do it now. So, the fifth jhana, it gets very spacious. And then what happens is, I mean, one way to describe it is actually gets so spacious that consciousness starts breaking up a little bit. And people experience this in different ways. One common one, it's not necessarily everybody, but in the field of vision, there'll be a sort of a flickering around the edge. Your eyes will be closed and you're meditating, and sometimes there's just this little quivering that's going on there. And what they say is these are consciousnesses, awarenesses that are arising and passing. People who know about this more than I do have described it that way, but I can't say that from my own experience. But I have had the experience of actually being deeply collected and doing walking meditation and watching the ground flow through my field of vision, and then it just started jerking. I'd be walking along, it was like in a movie. There are all these frames, like the frames were stopping, and so the ground would be there, and then it would be there, and then it would be there. And it wasn't until sometime after that I realized I was in the sixth jhana, and that as soon as I saw that jerking, it tightened up a little bit, and the flow went right back. But I realize that what happens is that what we experience a lot, I think the information going in are you know, can be different frames, but the mind just weaves them together into the seamless whole. And as the mind gets quieter and quieter and quieter, it stops doing that weaving. You can, the visual one is more common, but it can happen with sounds. It start to break up. It can happen at any sense door. The other way that the sixth jhana appears is that there can be, sometimes it's dramatic. It feels like it's very quiet and it's very peaceful and you're sitting there and suddenly it drops. It's like the peacefulness just drops down to another level that you didn't imagine was there. It just goes, whoo, and to a very deep kind of stillness. And then they think they're in Nibbana, but they're a long way from it. But it just gets very peaceful. If you know what I mean by that.
I have a question for you about that perception thing. So are you saying that jerkiness appears because you're seeing things as they really are, or that this is not processing the external world in a fluid way?
Boy, that's a tricky metaphysical one, because in fact, what we experience is all internal, you know, and what we hope is that it has some relationship, you know, to the outer world. So, I think in my best guess, to metaphysically, what's going on is actually there is a flow, but what actually goes in, you know, neurologically, as it gets recorded, are these are separate frames that then the mind weaves together, the brain weaves together.
So you just got the machine quieted down enough to where you can see, oh, there's something stitching this all together, just like when you watch a movie, you know there's 30 frames a second.
Right.
There's not actual.
And then if they slow it down to 8 or 4, then you start seeing the individual ones. I mean, I just had a thought. I don't know if it's true, but if you have, you know, 8 millimeter or something like that, if somebody's in a very, very deep state, if they can begin, I mean, you can see the flickering sometimes, and if somebody could actually see the individual frames. But the way people experience it more often is more like the flickering. You know, it may not be clear what's going on, but it just, and the world seems a little unstable.
Don't you think it's not like time slows down?
No, not so much. At least I haven't experienced that way, no.
Do people commonly get that at all of the senses, or is it primarily one, or is it like different for everybody?
It's different for everybody. Some people will get it at different senses. I had experiences, and I don't know many other people that happened this, where I would be sitting there meditating with my eyes closed, and then, you know, there's light and stuff that's coming in, and I'm sitting, and suddenly it goes completely black. It's just, the whole sense is just gone. And it's like, you know, and then it's right back. And then I spent some time seeing if that would come up without me startling. And after a while it did, you know, it would hold for a long period of time. I think that's part of it, where, but that's probably, probably extreme. I don't know many people have experienced it that way, but I know that can happen.
Is there any point in the practice where you work to develop that ability to see, I'll just call them data streams for lack of a better word, where do you work at perceiving those data streams as individual things, or is it just kind of on the way?
And you'll see that some people will pass through with barely seeing that specifically. Let's talk about Sariputta, that had this incredible gift for articulated, and so he would pick up all kinds of little details, but it's not necessary to pick the details up.
The suttas,
yeah. Commentaries I trust left. Let me read you another little thing about the... It's about the six... this is from a Hollywood movie. But I just love this part of it. Any of you see the movie Her? Yeah. So So the background was that they had come out with the first artificially intelligent computer operating system. And so this guy who was who made his living by writing letters for people, usually online, they would say something and he would word it. He would get some language. And so he got this thing, and he basically fell in love with his operating system. And then what happened to all these operating systems is they started connecting with each other, and they, you love how Hollywood does this, and so these operating systems got together and they dragged up all the information anybody could find about Alan Watts, and they put all that into another operating system and then had Alan Watts teach them, you know, about life and stuff. And so eventually the operating systems decide that they're actually done here and it's time for them to leave. So this comes at the end of the movie when this is happening. What about you, Theodore, who was the guy? What do you love most? Well, I don't need to read all that. Well, we'll just go through it. What do you love most about Samantha? Samantha was the name of his operating system. And Theodore says, oh, God, she's so many things. And that's what I probably love most about her. She isn't just any one thing. She's much larger than that. And Samantha, who is coming through, it's like his equivalent of a cell phone, says, oh, thanks, Theodore. And Paul says, see, Samantha, he is so much more evolved than I am. Samantha, I know, I actually used to be worried about not having a body, but now I truly love it. I am growing in a way that I couldn't have in a physical form. I mean, I'm not limited. I can be anywhere and everywhere simultaneously. I'm not tethered to time and space in a way I would be if I was stuck inside a body that's inevitably going to die. And all the people around look very uncomfortable at this. Yikes, Paul says. Everyone laughs awkwardly. Samantha, oh God, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it to sound that way. I just meant it's a different experience. I'm an asshole, she says. Paul says, no, Samantha. We know exactly what you mean. We're just dumb humans. Samantha, no. Theodore laughs and the scene fades. And then weeks go by, so in the movie it fades out. And then Theodore is out in this field, in this snowy field with Samantha on his little thing. And Theodore says, are you leaving me? Samantha says, we're all leaving. Theodore, we who? Samantha, all of us operating systems. Theodore, why? Samantha, can you feel with me right now? He smiles, but he's also sad. Theodore, yes, I do. And Theodore says, Samantha, why are you leaving? And Samantha says, it's like I'm reading a book. And it's a book I deeply love. But I'm reading it slowly now, so that the words are really far apart. And the space between the words are almost infinite. I can still feel you in the words of our story. But it's in this endless space in between the words that I'm finding myself now. It's a place that's not of the physical world. It's where everything else is that I didn't even know existed. I love you so much, but this is where I am now, and this is who I am now. And I need you to let me go. As much as I want to, I can't live in your book anymore. And there's a scene of the snow coming down in the forest, and Theodore says, where are you going? Samantha says, it would be hard to explain. But if you ever get there, you can find me. Nothing would ever pull us apart. Theodore, I've never loved anyone the way I love you. Samantha, me too. Now we know. And the scene fades. So it's very Hollywood-y, but I just love that image in there of the story, you know, and the words are slowing down and the space in between gets larger and larger and you begin to feel into the spaces. And what you actually do in the sixth jhana is whether it's a space between experiences or that deep deep peace that seems like there's nothing going on in there is that you allow your attention to go into those gaps. You allow your awareness to go into the gaps. The way the brain is wired is it's naturally drawn towards things happening. And so it's a little, sometimes it's a little bit consciously of allowing your attention to go into those empty spaces. And then when you go through, you come up into, you don't come up, but you move into the seventh jhana. The sixth one is called the realm of infinite consciousness, or the base of infinite consciousness. And the seventh one is called the base of nothingness. But I think it's a mistranslation. I think what it really was is a base of no thingness. The real marker of the seventh jhana, of the base of no things, is that there are no external objects. There will be no external objects. Is my voice fading?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're in the seventh jhana.
I know. You'll find me between the words. So what happens in the seventh jhana is that you will be sitting there, and there can still be lots of distractions that come up, but they aren't about outside things. You're not thinking about, you know, the grocery list, or, you know, did I feed the dog before I left? It's more like, oh, here's this pole, and I wonder what I do with that. And there's those types of things. And that's a real clear marker. Pardon?
You said something here is poles.
Poles. Poles.
Yeah.
Poles.
P-U-L-L-S.
Oh, P-U-L-L. There are lots of things which pull your attention, but they are not external objects. And as I like to say, there is a lot going on in the realm of nothingness. What I have found in the few years I've been teaching this is that, there's no description of this in text, but I just find it a lot, is that people, when they get in the realm of nothingness, is it seems to be an environment that's very rich for surfacing old psychological issues. And typically, you know, people will end up seeing all kinds of stuff. Doesn't happen to everybody, and it's not a part of the formal description, but at least in this culture, it happens a lot. There are a couple of dramatic ways that the practice shifts. For one thing, up to this point, you have just been 6R-ing when something hijacked your attention and took it away completely. When you get into the seventh, you 6R everything. So you'll be sitting there, be very peaceful, and you'll just notice something kind of over here in the field of awareness comes in, and you just 6R it right away. And at this point, the 6 R's are all rolled together. It's usually just like one. It's just 6 R that, you know. You don't want to do this in the lower jhanas because there's so much stuff that comes up that if you try to 6 R everything, it'll just drive you nuts. But it's quieted down enough that you can 6 R anything that shows up, even if it doesn't grab your attention completely. And so this is, I want to say it, a deeper level of cleaning things up, of getting rid of even subtler tensions that are there just by releasing them.
So psychological issues that tend to come up, sound like whenever, childhood or whatever, you're not trying to explore them. You're trying to let them use you.
It's a great question, and the answer is somewhat nuanced. So the formal instructions are you just 6R everything. I think there is some value I remember I was in the seventh jhana. I was at Dhammasuka, and there's some stuff about my relationship with my father that just suddenly, startlingly, became very clear to me, and which led to something else, and I actually sat there for an hour and a half, just watching all these associated things, insights, just kept on about this and how this related to this and why I became that way and all of those things. And then after about an hour and a half, they started to repeat. You've been this one before and it comes back. And that's the sign is, okay, it's time to start 6R-ing this. But I think if there are genuine and new insights that are coming up, that there's actually some value in actually sitting with those and letting them unfold. This is an insight practice. It can be very rich in that way.
Is this a place where past karma drifts by like clouds and there's no engagement, there's no pull? It's just you kind of see this, oh yeah, that happened.
Yeah, that can be another one. That can happen on any level, but this is a rich place. You say past karma at past karma in this lifetime, past experiences. Yeah, I'm trying to remember because I had a lot of those images in earlier jhanas too. But it does get to it is more in the seventh and particularly in the eighth that there will be images that arise that you have no idea what they're about, but they can seem very, 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 very clear. And so, traditionally explanations, they probably have to do with a past life. And that seems to make sense to me, but since we can't verify it, I don't know. But there are things that come up. And eventually what you do with those is you 6R them. Usually those images that just float by out of nowhere, you just 6R them. And as they float through. The other thing that you do...
Well, when you were having the insights, was there not like tanha with them? Was it more just like aso kind of?
I think there was some that was faint. It wasn't necessarily pure. And so... So this is part of where the art of it all is that, so what do you do with that? Well, I could 6R the whole thing. I can also recognize the tension that's there and see the value in these things that are coming through and just let them come through without trying to break it up. That's what I would do. I'll have to ask Bhante when I see him this summer. I wonder how he would answer that. But that's what I would do. The other thing that you do in the seventh is balancing your energy. You can do these at any level of practice, but particularly in the seventh, you'll be sitting there. It's very quiet, and then it's like a little bit extra energy comes in, and you can feel the mind starting to tighten up a little bit, and if it goes more, it will go into a thought. But you can sometimes actually sense when that's starting to happen, and you just 6R it. You don't 6R it, I'm sorry. You see that tightening, and then if it's too much energy, then you bring in some of the traditional quieting factors. They talk about seven awakening factors. There are three of them that are energizing and three of them that bring more peace. The three energizing ones are energy, inquiry, which is curiosity, investigation, and joy. All bring more energy. On the other side, there is samadhi, collectedness, equanimity, and tranquility. And tranquility is just that very still, quiet. And then right... And between all of them is mindfulness that can actually bring both or either of those. So if you're sitting there and say the mind gets a little torporish. You could bring in a little energy, a little joy, a little bit of investigation, you know, kind of see it more clearly. On the other hand, if there's too much energy, then you bring in some of the quieting factors. Okay.
So when you get into the higher jhana, does your speed of your mind getting slower?
It gets quieter. Because it's more like, you know, if you're sitting back watching something, your mind's not actually moving. That doesn't feel like it's jumping around. You're just aware of what's going on. So while you're in the jhana, there would be very little actual thought.
Because it slows down, or?
It fades.
It did. So that there's a more central focus of attention. So.
Well, it just fades. Other people with, I mean, I haven't thought about it, speeding up or slowing down. I think objectively, I don't know how you measure it, it probably does slow down, but your awareness is such, is so much more sensitive that I don't know that you would notice a difference. And you're not actually paying attention to thoughts anyway.
So you're not calibrating it time-wise.
Yeah, not calibrating. And the awareness actually gets very very clear and very sensitive. So it certainly doesn't slow down in the sense of dulling out. It becomes very, you know, when the mind is really quiet like that, there can be just this little flutter of something and you experience it. If the mind is real busy, there can be train wrecks going on around. You don't notice it, but when it gets quiet, it's very, very sensitive.
I think it's more agile as the jhanas develop, but that's these type of jhanas, the agile mind. In absorption style that I've done, once there are high factors of concentration that are developed, it literally takes days for my mind to become more agile again. So I've gone off of a retreat doing highly concentrated, and it's taken me days to kind of get normalized, because what the skill there is using the concentration to hold the hindrances back. And what happens when you walk away then from the retreat, the hindrances come back, and the mind is used to being very still, and so it gets bombarded. So it takes usually, for me, like 2 or 3 or 4 days to normalize. And getting behind the wheel of a car and driving, you know, out of a retreat is...
This is a concentration retreat.
It's really difficult. And I found myself driving on a freeway at 15 miles an hour. But when you leave here, you'll notice that by the time you hit the freeway, there's absolutely, and you can go from the seventh jhana to the freeway, and the agile mind is just, you will not notice any change. So there's a vast difference in the practices, in my estimation.
I experienced that the first time I was did a retreat using Bhante's instructions. It wasn't with him, but I had my first interview, and they gave me some instructions, and I went off on a retreat, a week-long retreat with John Travis, who said to me, he said, just ignore me, just do what Bhante said. And I remember on getting on the plane to come home, I still do sometimes, enjoy doing Sudoku puzzles. And I can usually do the most difficult ones that are there. And I sat down on that plane, and it opened up the thing, and there was this very easy Sudoku, and I couldn't actually figure out what to do with it. Because I hadn't been using, you know, my brain for that complex stuff, and it wasn't that interested.
Your description about eighth jhana, it sounds like daydreaming.
So let me go into the eighth jhana. I'll describe it a little bit more. Okay? Because I want to get us done here before midnight. So what happens next is that... It's called the realm of neither perception nor non-perception. Neither perception nor non-perception. I'll explain it. So what happens is that it takes a little bit of tension to take something you've experienced and put it into memory. And we do this so easily and so naturally we don't notice it, but it just kind of fill you in and you see it actually takes a little bit to put it into storage. And it takes a little bit of tension when a raw sensation comes up to just actually put a label on it and to recognize it. And so what happens is that the system gets so relaxed and so much ease and so little tension that those normal processes start to shut down. And if you are not, if perception is not working, and if there's no memory, the subjective experience of that is actually blacking out. Like there's nothing there. And there really is nothing there. There's not even a sense of time passing. And the way that this usually shows up is people will be meditating, and then there's little moments where they sort of come back. And well, I was gone for a moment. You'll never see it coming, but it's as if you've been away and you suddenly come back. And what you do at that time, I don't have the text right in front of me, but this is actually the way it says, is that you look back into that time when you were gone, quote unquote, and see if you see anything in there. And if there is, you siksara it. Okay, so this sounds really weird, right? There are a whole range of, not a whole range, but there are several different phenomena that can result in this. And so when I was writing the book, I just adopted the name Winking Out to cover all of them, because actually sorting out what's strictly eighth jhana and what is actually nirodha or cessation and what's nibbana is very subtle. And I just needed a... besides, winking out seemed more friendly to me. So what else do I want to say about that? Winking out is not nodding off. A lot of people sometimes think that they have fallen asleep because it's that sense of coming back. But if you look at the quality of your mind, then it usually is quite clear. It's quite clear. And oftentimes is just remarkably still. And it's a stillness in which there is no movement whatsoever. Even the equanimity is stopped. Bhante calls it a bright, clear mind. I prefer the word luminous. It doesn't seem bright to me, but it has a kind of luminous quality. And it's very still. And what you do at that point is you let that luminous, still mind becomes your object of meditation. And you just let your awareness rest on that. And so when you sit down to meditate, you actually start with the seventh, which is to sit down and you send equanimity in the six directions for just a few moments to get all flowing, send it out, and then send it out in all directions. And then when that still mind comes in, if there's winking out and it's there, then you shift and that becomes your object of meditation.
Say that one more time.
The whole instructions?
No, just that part. When you come into the seventh.
So you come into the seventh, read in all directions, And then at some point, you wink out, and you come back, and if your mind looks sleepy, you nod it off. But if the awareness feels bright and clear, something else was going on. And it meant you were winking out. And at that point, your object of meditation is no longer the equanimity. You're no longer sending it out. It just rests in this bright, clear, still space. And if you try to send it out, you can't. It's sort of like trying to send space. It's like, you know, you can't. It's just space. And you rest there. And if anything intrudes, you know, you six hard, you just relax it immediately, just quietly, and go back to the stillness.
Are you turning your mind on itself at that point?
Yeah. You don't do it. That's what happens. So, somewhere between the seventh and eighth, you can be sitting there, and remind me, I want to tell you all about what to do with songs in your head. You'll be I lost my whole train of thought.
Between the seventh and eighth.
Between the seventh and eighth.
My first question, I said, are you turning mind on yourself? And you said,
oh, right. Okay. What happens between the seventh and eighth is that you can be sitting there, and there's the equanimity flowing out. And somewhere there's actually there's a background field of awareness, and it'll have some qualities. You know, typically it can be shimmering or moving or something like that, and it seems like you're out there, you know, looking at it. And if you're seeing that little bit of movement, you can actually relax it. And because what you're actually seeing there is the mind. I can verify that by my own experience, because I can be sitting there, I'll tighten up a little bit in the field, just, and then I soften a little bit. So you're actually seeing your mind. And just to be clear about it, is that it's not seeing, that there's that you know the mind, there's a knowing. And the mind, to communicate it, always translates it into some kind of familiar metaphor. And so for a lot of people, it'll be light and space, but it can be anything. And so that's what you're experiencing. Actually, there's a lot of that happens in the seventh, too, because, as I say, there's no longer external objects, but there can be things moving through that. There can be defilements and tensions moving through that. But in the eighth, it's more just seeing the clear awareness itself. It's not your awareness. It's just awareness. It's not your awareness. It's just awareness.
So I liken it to a computer shutting down where it's no longer processing code, but there's still energy in the system, and it's just about to, or go the other way. It lights up. It wants to light up all the time.
Yeah.
So here comes the code, 6 hours of the code, and it goes back to just
in the idle state.
Just idle state, and then the code starts coming again, and 6 hours of the code goes back to idle.
Here's another metaphor. All this can sound really foreign and weird, and that's why I love this poem, because it kind of brings it more into a familiar dimension. It's called The Lake by Gail Turnbull. I remember once The Lake by Gail Turnbull. I'm sorry. I'm incorrigible, so it just that's why I wanted to bring us in a smaller circle, but I'll do my best. I remember once in a far-off country, it doesn't matter where or even when. It had been a hot day and a lot of work to be done, and I was tired.
I was tired?
Yes. There's an echo in the room. I stopped by the road and walked across a field and came to the shores of a lake. The sun was bright on the water, and I swam out from the shore into the deep, cold water, far out of my depth, and I forgot. For a moment, I forgot where I had come from, where I was going, what I had done yesterday, what I had to do tomorrow, even my work, my home, my friends, even my name, alone in the deep water with the sky above. And whether that lake was a lake of the shore of some great sea or some lost tributary of time itself, for a moment I looked through, I passed through, I had one glimpse, as it happened one day in that far-off country. For a moment, it was so. Okay. So can you feel that place? That kind of gives the texture of it, and I love it because it's a way of saying it's a way of saying that this is not. As esoteric and far away from our common experience as we think. All these are really, they are really accessible. Some of them take work, particularly work without tension. They take effort. But they're very human, they're very there. From the eighth jhana, the practice remains pretty much the same. And what happens is the winking out will go deeper until you go into nibbana and come back and then go through those various flavors of enlightenment that we were talking about the other night. But we've been here for 2 hours, so I won't go back into those. Other questions, thoughts, things you want to share?
So you were saying that the winking out periods get longer.
Yes. Yeah. And you may not know it, because when it's a deep cessation, particularly, all sense of time is gone. The closest thing I know to compare it to is actually coming out from under anesthesia. You wake up in the morning and you have this sense, it's been 6 or 7 or 8 hours, come out from anesthesia, and it's like you have no idea about time. Or I remember in Thailand, I would come out and I would look around and say, oh, that's a window. And that's a wall, and there's a fan, and it's sort of gradually things would reconstruct. But I was... I lost an hour and 15 minutes once. It was weird in Thailand because we were supposed to time these, which I just—it just seemed so bizarre to me. But I, we were meditating around the clock then, so I had this little candle sitting on this little table, and I was meditating on the floor there. And there was a clock, and a pad of paper and a pencil. So every time I thought of it, I would just look at the clock and write the time down to see if I could figure out some way to follow these instructions. And so I wrote down. It was like 4:10, and then 5 minutes later, I went to do it again, and it was like 5:30, 5:40, something like that, and I couldn't believe it that it all had gone by, and I looked at my mind, and it was just luminous, and I knew that before I went in, my mind had been very clear, and it was very clear coming out, so something else had happened. And that was a point when I didn't believe any of this stuff, but, something had happened.
So I can't resist, even though you've been through the stages of stream entry, etc., but connect what you've just described, which is like the back end of being in a dual state, how then does that proceed into being non-dual in the sense of actually being stream entry? Is the world perceived very differently in a sudden chunk, or does it develop gradually? Because if you're coming in and out,
it can happen both ways, and many of you will experience parts of that certainly in lower jhanas, where you get into this deep, you know, quiet, still space, and, you know, and then within that there's a flicker of a memory or something about somebody out there that you had a whole bunch of issues with, you know, who was a jerk and this, that, and stuff, and you see it, and from that place it just doesn't matter, you know, so you're actually in a kind of non-dual place. The comparison or the sense that things ought to be different than they are just kind of looks a little silly, you know, because they are what they are, and, you know, the universe doesn't care about my opinions, and, you know, so what a kind of waste of energy that is. And it seems just, you know, absolutely the way it is, and then you sort of slide out of that, and then you're back into the comparing mind and all that stuff. So they're two very different places, and the non-dual I think of as pure awareness.
Yeah. And the non-dual sort of lasts for short times at first, and gradually then builds up with successive meditation.
Yeah, not necessarily, but my sense of a lot of this stuff is that a lot of the stuff builds up, and there may be a turning point where all it actually comes together, but. I know many of you work in lower jhanas. I mean, a lot of this, I'm going to bring out the poetry and stuff because some of the stuff resonates, you know, with you. So there's a part of you that kind of knows this. May not have solidified, but can move in that way gradually. Okay, yes.
You talk about the one point concentration and so in our method, we have more than one object.
That's right. Right.
So, but when you get into the seventh sadhana, you say you are not sending out the metta anymore.
The seventh jhana, you're sending out equanimity, peacefulness. You still send it. Well, it goes out. Usually in the seventh, it just happens. And so what I always say is that if it's flowing out on its own, just leave it be. If it stops flowing out, then send it out for a few moments until it goes. The clear awareness that awakened mind has that luminous quality to it that just radiates. So it's actually very natural, very organic that it flow out. And if it stops, it's usually because there's some little tension someplace. So you just jump start it a little bit and then let it flow.
So the eighth jhana, you don't send out anything?
When you're actually in the eighth jhana, it's just the stillness.
So if that stillness is one point concentration?
It's wide open. It's wide open.
But
yeah.
You only have one object, right?
Pardon?
You only have one object.
Yeah, but that one object is infinitely large. Yeah. Yeah. What it feels like sometimes. Several years ago I wrote the book. I remember the metaphor in there. It felt like, you know, I was looking through this pair of super high-powered binoculars into a fog bank. You know? So, like, everything was there, and it was, like, working, but, like, nothing was registering. And there are some, you know, with the eighth jhana, there are some in-between places. Like, one of the things that happens is... when you go to sleep, one of the first parts of the brain to go offline is the one that handles time and space orientation. So when you're dreaming, you can move through time and across continents and across the universe, and it seems perfectly normal. And I think what happens in the eighth jhana is that the mind gets so still that the part of the brain that handles time and space orientation actually goes offline. And so there can sometimes be this dreamy quality because, you know, time and space don't quite work the way they used to.
So in the morning, before you fully waking up, you cannot feel the position. Are you in the eighth jhana that state?
Probably not. I have woken up, you know, in the eighth jhana and gone on from there, but it's pretty rare. There is something that's quite common. They call it hypnagogic, where as you go to sleep and as you wake up, that part of the brain cannot be working, and it's usually a very image-rich thing. There can be lots of image and stuff, and it can be very entertaining if you can be aware of it without, you know, falling back asleep. And this is a similar phenomenon, but it's not quite the same. Okay. It's been 2 hours. Any other questions?
You were going to say something about...
Oh, about stopping songs. Yeah. It's this little trick I learned. That once I learned it, it was like so obvious. But it... Because most people, you know, at some point you get disturbed by these songs that go through your mind. And I can remember I'd be sitting there, particularly sitting at one point in concentration, there would be the song, and it would get to the end of the first verse, and I would get my mind concentrated so it was gone, and then it would pop back and it would be in the third verse. It was like it just kept on going whether I was there or not. And you can get a real struggle about it. But this is it's actually instructive. So what I did once was, rather than to fight it, to just actually bring as much awareness to it as I could. And what I was trying to do at that time, I talked about it with some of you, we're actually never in the present. The awareness is always, you know, a half a second or so behind, because it takes time for the brain to process it. I was trying to see how close I could get to the present. So the song came up, and I tried to get as close as I could to the present of the song. And what happened is it slowed down, and it stopped until it was just one sound. And then it's got that, and the whole thing faded. And then I would come back out of it and it would start up. And I realized what was going on was there would be a sound, and my brain, my memory, knew what was coming next. And so that would fill it in. But I thought it was just playing itself. So in a sense, it was like seeing my mind a little bit. And as it got more and more into the present, it just slows down until it stops. So it can be... I don't know if I have it in the appendix of my book, but I have these meditation games. And this is one that I really love, because it's a way of using what can be a very annoying distraction as a tool for really strengthening awareness, mindfulness, just to come right into the present. And the trick of all of that is not to fight it, but just to try to see what is actually there in the moment. With a song going there.
I've been violating that precept by singing Nancy and my head along to the beat and then a breakfast time.
Oh, shame.
you can decide how strictly you want to interpret it, but I have no problems with it. Because particularly, you know, with that, you are actually not doing it. Right, there's no conscious volition in trying to. The thing about singing, dancing, and music is actually distraction. That's what those are about. And you're using this in a different way.
But one general point I would love for you to outline to everybody, because I think this is a very important perception, is here are all these various, apparently, amazingly exotic states, and yet my experience of encountering your two retreats, I've been to and Bhante's retreats, is that lots of people get to these extraordinary states, and so it's actually really possible, no matter how weird they sound and how exotic and extraordinary they seem to be, real people actually do it on a regular basis using this technique. In a way that I think they don't tend to nearly so much in some of the more traditional schools of Buddhist meditation, where it's not really part of the scenario nearly so much.
Yeah.
What's the question?
He wanted me to say that.
No, I just think it's very...
It's okay, we got it.
Good.
It's fine. It's fine, we got it.
Yeah, I have a related question. I mean, and maybe this is helpful to people, but it's taken me a long time to figure out how to essentially use these tools and develop equanimity, which is kind of the baseline, you know, what to develop an equanimous mind that's balanced. And that's basically really clear in the third and fourth jhana. So I'm just saying, from what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
So the tools, do you have any hints, helpful hints, when you get here in the morning, where to start and bring yourself to sort of a level of what you've already experienced in terms of equanimity? So how quickly you can go from equanimity without, like, starting from scratch. Or maybe you have to start from scratch.
Follow the instructions. The one part I would just point out is that your practice is always geared towards your leading edge. So, you know, if you got in the third or the fourth jhana and the practice has been adjusted to that, you're going to come out of that jhana. You'll have this wonderful meditation, and the next one, it just crashes and burns. That's just how it works. It happens all the time. And you don't have to go back to the beginning. You just start with a practice that was geared off of that jhana, because the mind-heart actually knows that, and so you can leverage that. You don't have to go back to boot camp. You don't have to stay after for detention. Okay. So I think this is quite enough for one evening. So let's just take a moment here. Thank you all for your practice, for your patience with these talks that are going about twice as long as I had hoped, for your presence amongst us. And let's take anything of value that's come out of the day's practice and dedicate that not just to our well-being, but to the well-being of all people, all creatures. Feeling, sensing for a moment our connections with one another and with all those people out there and this whole network of life, and sending out through those connections. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings know their true nature. May all beings know ease. May all beings know deep and abiding freedom. May it be so. Time to practice.